hopefully that will come up there and sounds like rain with this thing going on. Okay, get all this done here. All right. Okay, Romans part 9. We are in chapter 3. Titled is None, No Not One. But I just want to say something. Maybe it's a conversation for later. I kind of know what they mean. But then it just made me start pondering. You know how things will hit you sometimes for the first time ever. And, you know, Don Keatley has that, I think we talked about it Sunday, that Grace Awakening Network. And I don't know if you get all the notifications that come in on Messenger and, you know, all that stuff comes in all the time. And it came up there a few minutes ago when somebody was asking about looking for a Grace Church in their area. You saw that. So I'm looking, I'm like, where are they from? Where are they from? And I think they from Baton Rouge. I think that was where my investigation took me. I could be wrong. But, you know, you for a moment you get excited like, oh, maybe they're from Cedar Bluff and we'll, yeah. But, no, I just was reading through some of the comments and you know, there were several on there where people had left. They had left their church. And, you know, all of us have done that. And, you know, I got to thinking about that because, you know, I guess the question just kind of comes up, okay, why? Well, obviously, you're not satisfied. I mean, that's plain. We know the answer to that. But then my question got to be, well, why? And, you know, we can blame, and I know all of our stories are a little bit different, but they're all kind of connected. Maybe they're preaching something we disagree with or whatever along those lines. But, you know, this terminology, and I guess that was kind of my question, the terminology they were looking like, we're looking for a Grace Church. Well, I began to wonder, is there any church in the United States that's going to claim they're not a Grace Church? I don't think so. So I guess, you know, my question was, well, what do you mean by that? I wish I could talk to them like, what do you mean by that? Because, you know, it's almost like, well, hey, you know, we don't want to be under any rules. I mean, is really that what you mean? Because, you know, that's, when I think about that, I mean, even, you know, I'm reading in the scriptures where the Lord said, I'll write my laws in your heart and on your mind. So, and here, as we've discovered here, Paul in this letter to Romans writes, hey, guys, come to our church. I'm a slave of Jesus Christ. Now, wait a minute. Time out here. I mean, sometimes I just think about these things. Now, Paul, this doesn't sound like a church. I want to, oh, come over here to our church and you can be a slave of Jesus Christ. Ah, we want freedom. And then I hear Jesus says, you'll know the truth and the truth will make you free. And then Paul says, my freedom looks like slavery. You understand? So I wonder, what do they mean? And even go back in our experience, what did we mean when the church that we were at become unfulfilling and we were unsatisfied and we moved on? You know, and then what are we really seeking and looking for? I mean, this is a question for me. Hopefully it's a question for you. And I guess the question ought not to be what we're seeking for, but whom? Who? And I thought maybe maybe early on in our career as Christians, in our career as Christians, we had more of a what focus than a who focus. I'm not speaking for you guys, but I'm wondering in my own self, I'm looking back and I really, you know, that little question that she asked made me do some investigating in my own mind. And I thought, man, I think we were looking for a what. I think I was looking for a what, a good feeling, a kingdom coming, you know, all of these Christian things that we, all of these whats, and never a who. And to hear Paul says, all that I might know him. And I just thought, wow. Because when your focus gets there, boy, everything changes. Everything changes. So I just wondered that to my own, you know, my own kind of self. Because, you know, even now you'll have people do that. Well, you know, I read some on there, and really for the first time, you know, I used to read those things, and my heart would leap, you know, like, all right, they're coming out of it. But then I thought, you've been at the church 20 years and you left. And my heart was sad for the first time. My heart was sad. It's like a family split. I mean, it really is. It had never hit me that way until today when I read it. Maybe I'm getting older, more sentimental, but I thought, wow, you've been there 20 years. I mean, obviously there has to be some strong bonds there, obviously. And you left, man. And you know, sometimes that's just as much legalistic as the ones who stayed. Because now we jump up and down and say, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free. But you're not really free. You don't even know what you're looking for. So I just, you know. Those things kind of give me pause a little bit. So here in Romans, so far, Paul has introduced us to the idea of the gospel or the good news of God is the fact that God is always faithful to us, that we can count on him, we can trust him. Even as I was studying this right here, I had to go back, and I mean, even in this first line I wrote, you know, I got to thinking again myself, you know, just pondering these little things. Because we're so accustomed to thinking that when things aren't right, or maybe we haven't been, you know, from our side as faithful, then we think maybe God has withdrew. I mean, maybe I'm the only one who's thinking that. And you know, again, you'll battle in your mind, well, why would God bless me here? You know, because I really haven't earned. And so we go back to this kind of legalistic mindset. And I'll be honest with you, this is just something that's culturally kind of bred into us. It doesn't matter which church you go to. I mean, you go down here, you go over here, it doesn't really matter. I'm not blaming any churches whatsoever. It's culturally bred into us. Merit, reward, all of this kind of stuff. So, you know, as I was doing this, and you know, we all got these things that are going on in the background. When I say the background, events, circumstances, situations, potentials, you know, all of this other stuff is going on all around us. And we pray about them and ponder them and all of these things, and then sometimes, you know, you just think, why would God help me here? I haven't done anything in this situation to merit anything. I haven't even prayed sufficiently in this situation. I never have one situation going on at one time. That'd be easy, wouldn't it? Nah, there's 17. So, and you know, some of them takes a lot of your focus. And then this one will rear up, and then you'll look at it and you'll think, well, I really haven't. But, you know, in that, we can trust God to be faithful to us, no matter what. And if we can kind of get this mindset in this book of Romans, I think this is what Paul is writing to us. And you know, sometimes in these evangelical circles, we subtly shift the focus so that it almost sounds as if our faith is the most important part of the good news, you know, our faith. Do you believe in Jesus enough? And that certainly is important, don't get me wrong. But for Paul, the real crux of the good news is that God is always faithful, even when we aren't. I mean, that's big. You know, that's a rest, isn't it? That's a rest. And for Paul, the way that God is faithful, now listen to this, is that he sent his son, and he has proved his son through resurrection. And we believe only because we come to understand that God would never, never, ever leave us on our own. This is why, as Christians, Jesus has to always be the lens through which we reinterpret everything. And in fact, that's a lot of what Paul is doing in Romans. I mean, Paul, he knows... he's part of this Jewish tradition. He knows the Hebrew scriptures, and he also knows that he has met and even now worships Jesus. Everything changes when he meets Jesus. You know, we read over there in Hebrews that Jesus is the only exact, the express image of God. And the Greek word there, I don't know, that express image, you know what the Greek word is? Character. I mean, what a word. We get our Greek word character, or we get our word character from that word. You know, it's spelled different, but the literal meaning of that word is you take a stamp and press that into metal to make a coin. Or you press it into wax to make a stamp or a seal. And the writer is saying that Jesus is God pressed into the world, so that we can now finally and fully seeing what God would look like. Not just in our imagination, not just in our writings, but what God would actually look like pressed into the world. And yet, because the God that is revealed in Jesus is so unbelievably graceful, and because the divine anger that's revealed in Jesus is not actually directed at you and me, or even at his enemies. You know, you remember what Jesus said for us to do with our enemies, right? Yeah, pray for them, love them. I mean, what kind of crazy doctrine is that? I say things, you know, that gets me taken off sometimes, but what if our politics was governed that way? I'll say it real nice. Love your enemies, not go to war with them. Well, you don't make money in love, do you? Only one day a year, Valentine's Day. Other than that, there's a lot of money to be made on the other side. His anger, God's anger, is only ever directed at what hurts us. You know, our selfishness, our greed, our exclusion, pain. Then the question that naturally follows is, I mean, this is a question we got to ask. Then why am I bothering to be a good person at all? If God is faithful regardless, I mean, Jesus is always gracious, and all that hurts me will eventually be burned away by God anyway, then why not just sit back, you know, eat, drink, and be merry? You know, who cares? I mean, this is This is a question people will ask. Either you're a strict law keeper over here on this side, or, you know, I'm free. This is kind of the question, right? I'm free. I don't want to have to keep any laws. I want to be free. These are some of the questions, you know, Paul will address later on in this book. Should we sin more that grace may abound? I mean, God forbid, you guys have missed the whole point. And what's interesting in Romans is we actually don't know whether people were making that argument against Paul or whether he just thinks they will. But that's the question he's dealing with, whether it's hypothetical or otherwise. He's dealing with here in the opening of chapter 3. And you remember Paul's response here in verse 4. God forbid. You remember that? That was an emphatic, I'll just say it. It was an emphatic, oh, hell no. And many of the Bible scholars, that's what they say. So grace is at the heart of the gospel. In fact, grace is gospel, but grace will always require a certain maturity for us to understand. A certain maturity there. You know, there's some things that we'll be talking about later, you know, as we go on. But I'm telling you, it's for mature audiences only. I mean, really, because it's so huge when you understand that God has given us these pictures over and over and over. And when you pull back and you begin to see and understand, my gosh. You know, we have Christ in us. There is no doubt. We are in Him, like we were talking Sunday about this potential. But you know, you can only live out what you comprehend and understand. Even though you've received the fullness, you know, it's like a child. The child has two legs and two arms and a head and a body and, you know, 10 fingers and 10 toes, but he can't walk. He doesn't have the strength to do anything. So he's got to have that maturity to be able to operate in this matter. So we see a church now, we say, oh, the church is without power and all this other stuff. Well, really, that's not true. The church has all power. They don't have the maturity to go with it. And that's just the way it is. We see that naturally so. And, you know, I don't know, it'd be like they pass a law and they say, hey, you know what? I know we was talking about Nevaeh driving. It'd be like, hey, well, let's pass a law. And we think that boys and girls at the age of 7 are mature enough to drive a vehicle. But, I mean, we kind of laugh. But in the church, we think, oh, maturity don't have nothing to do with it. We just want to cast out demons and steal the storms and heal the sick. And, hey, here we go. Well, guys, the potential's there. But it takes this maturity. Jesus didn't even do nothing until he was 30. I mean, that ought to tell us something right there. But anyway. But this question, you know, why not just eat, drink, and be merry? I mean, the truth is, you're right. You could be terrible and God would still be faithful to you. God would still be good to you. Yeah. Why? Because he's good. I mean, if you ever think, hey, well, I'm good and I'm deserving something, you've messed that up. So then that poses the question, why should we be good? See, that's why on the less mature level, we have to pose questions to keep people in bondage. Well, you know, I mean, you'll lose your salvation. You know, we gotta do things like, it's like us telling our little kids, you know, well, you know, why should you pick your room up? Well, we don't really have a good reason. We can't explain it. So we'll tell them, well, Santa Claus is watching. And if you don't clean your room, then you don't get no presents from Santa Claus. You know, why shouldn't I punch my sister in the eye? Well, you know, so we go into the, but as you get mature, you begin to understand, and now So one of the things that Paul is telling us here is that if you're looking for loopholes, you're just not getting it. Because isn't that what kids will do? Looking for loopholes. Well, how do I get out of doing my homework? Well, how can I get out of picking room? Well, I'll pick half the room up today and half tomorrow. And, you know, really, how? But the truth is, participating in God's story isn't a punishment. It's an invitation. Being a good person is not what you have to do to be loved. It's what you get to do once you realize you are loved. God works in you both to will and do of his good pleasure. It's a new desire that comes up. And that's the default position that underpins everything that Paul is writing here. The faithfulness of God is bigger than we think it is. If you're looking for loopholes, you'll find them. But if you're looking for God, he promises you'll find him instead. So, that's introduction. Introductory. So, Romans chapter 3, I'm going to read verses 9 through 20, and I have the King James today. Not that it matters. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have been proved, for we have before proved, both Jews and Gentiles, that they are all under sin. Or all under, when I say all under a sin, I want you to, I want you to hear it this way. They're all under the power. They're all under the authority, if you will, of the tyrant. Now, remember, it was not sons in Egypt. It was the children in Egypt who were under the tyrant of Pharaoh. And boy, I don't want to go down that road, but there is so much there. So they're under the tyrant. They're under the bondage. They're under the tyranny of sin. Under sin, Paul would say. And remember, this was the big point from last week. The Jews do have the Hebrew scriptures. They have the oracles of God. And that was a big bonus. Remember, they're advantaged in every way. But it's not a free pass, because we're all on level ground before God, regardless of our background, regardless of our history, our ethnicity? Some of them words I don't even try to spell them, because if you knew my spelling. Ethnicity. Yeah, there it is. I know if I practice it 3 times. Ethnicity. None of that matters. Verse 10, because he writes, as it is written. So what's he about to do? He's about to quote a verse, right? He's about to quote a scriptures. And you know what, guys? It's going to be a doozy. Because, boy, anybody in the Christian churches is going to know these passages right here, right? Boy, this is it. This is where we hang our hats. I mean, hang on to these. There is none righteous. How many? No, not one. So we kind of toot our horns right there, right? I mean, there is none righteous. No, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are altogether become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. How many? No, not one. Do you guys know where that's from? Psalm 14. He's not done, though. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. That's out of Psalm 5. The poison of apes is under their lips. Psalm 140. Whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Psalm 10. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. In the way of peace they have not known. Isaiah 59. There is no fear of God before their eyes, Psalm 36. And just to finish this off, Paul adds this, now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight. For by the law or through the law is the knowledge of sin. Got a lot to unpack here. So as we go back to verse 10, there is none righteous, no, not one. Again, that's from Psalms 14. And as we've already seen in Paul's letter here, several times, Paul is paraphrasing. Paul does something that we Christians aren't allowed to do, I guess. You know, you get these warnings all the time. And Paul is using scriptures to make his point. But whenever they don't say exactly what he wants them to communicate, he simply changes them. Now, who do you know has the authority to change scriptures? But yet Paul does. If it doesn't sound right, he changes it. Now, that doesn't need to be scary for us. We just need to understand what's going on here. I remember Dad talking about Uncle Stuart one time, and he had always quoted that verse wrong, something about walking as you've received the Lord, walk ye in him. And he said, as much as you've received him, you said you just quoted the scripture wrong. And he says, well, it ought to say it that way. You remember that? It ought to say it that way. And, you know, you remember those things. Well, this is kind of what Paul is doing here. Now, first of all, the Psalms that Paul is using here, they were originally written in Hebrew. Now, Paul is quoting from the Greek translation of the Hebrew, from the Septuagint. And that would have been the translation most familiar to Paul and his readers at that time, the Septuagint. But also as a Pharisee, Paul, a Hebrew of Hebrews, he certainly would have read and understood the Hebrew writing as well. He would have had both, right? The Greek, Septuagint, and the Hebrew. He knew them both. But he's writing in Greek to people who read Greek, so he starts with the Greek translation. Now, what we need to understand is that Judaism, and by extension, Christianity, have always adopted the technology of translation. What we have said is that the power in our religious text is not in the magic of the words, right? Some people do. You know, I've seen signs, King, you know, our church, King James only. And if we, you know, I used to hear people say, well, if they was in the spirit, they wouldn't have misquoted that verse. You know, these, like, you know, almost like witch's brew, and you got to say abracadabra just exactly right, or you mess the spell up. The power's not in that. It's in the message that is communicated to us, right? Now, this is one of the ways that we depart from our Muslim brothers. In Quran, it's kept in Arabic, so that the original words are never corrupted. So if you want to read the Quran, you got to read it in Arabic because they're afraid you'll mess the words up. You know, I heard somebody talking like, you know, one time, it's like, we got to remember these old songs because if we get the tune wrong, you know, it's almost like, boy, if we mess this song up, that's it. Now, in Christianity, our words have been translated as broadly as possible from the very beginning. Now, of course, they work very hard to make sure they're saying the same thing in different languages and contexts, right? Because, you know, If it's King James only, then only the American reading people can read it, you know. I talked to Barrow the other day. They're trying to buy some more Sabano Bibles. Well, guess what? They can't read King James English in the Philippines, right? The people in Mexico can't read King James English, so I guess they're all doomed. But anytime you translate language, you inherently accept a level of transmissive transformation, if you will. Because in language there's nuance, there's syntax, which that's the arrangement of words and phrases to create sentence, you know, the syntax. There's limitations to language that just introduce complexity when you translate. You know, the Greek language is a beautiful language, and I always say the American English language I always thought was lazy. I mean, it's just mine, you know. You hear somebody talking in French or God help you if you can understand anything in a Slavic language, any of that stuff. Boy, oh boy, I'm just or the Eastern languages, I have no idea what they're saying, none. But you know, with Spanish, you can kind of. So you got all of those things coming into translation. And this is why that we are still translating the English Bible, though we did it over 400 years ago in the King James. And, you know, when I first came back to the church, I said, I'm going to get me a real King James Bible. Because the Bible that everybody reads now that says King James ain't the original King James. Trust me, you couldn't read it. It's written in Shakespearean language. Words are spelled. I got one. I looked. I said, oh, my gosh, I gave it away. And this guy took it. He thought he had something really special. I'm sure he can't read it either. I mean, if we all talk like Shakespeare, then it would be good. Now, Paul, he sets this long line of scholars that saw language as a tool rather than a sentence, because he wants to communicate, not just with words we're saying, he wants to communicate what the words are saying. You know, the words were saying something in Psalms, but now what are they saying to us? Right? Because remember, the scriptures weren't written to us. They were written for us. So we got to see what are they saying to us. We know what they were saying to the Colossian church. But now what is it saying to me now? And for Paul, especially now as he looks back on them having encountered the story of Jesus. Wow, that changes everything. Now, what Psalm 14 originally said is that there is no one who does good. I think it starts out, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. I think that's Psalm 14. And he says that there is no one who does good in Psalm 14. And now he repeats that line. And Paul keeps it the same in verse 12, but he changes it. There's no one who is righteous. The reason for that is that Psalm 14 is all about how bad people do bad things. Let me go over there and read. Yeah, I got it right here. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They are all gone aside. They are all together become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Now, when I said the word righteous here, when Paul changed it, that's going to be over in the NIV, but not in the King James, right? So, you know, this translation here. And this psalm, again, is about people who ignore God, how they do terrible things. except that Paul's point here in Romans is that actually it's about all of us. Because I want you to understand, from a Hebrew mindset, they were always pointing out there saying, none of them is good. We're good. We have the oracles of God. I mean, see, we're looking at it from a Gentile. But remember, there's both in this church, including the barbarians. So the Jews were sitting there thinking, yeah, we know what Psalm 14's about. Psalm 14's about y'all. And Paul is saying, no, it's about all of us, not just the non-religious, not just the Gentiles. We all fall short of the glory of God, which he'll say in verse 23 a little bit later. Yeah, sure, you may do some good things because you keep the law and you follow the rules, but Paul's point is that alone doesn't make you righteous. Just being a good Jew who follows the rules isn't enough. I think sometimes this goes back to my question earlier because, you know, people are looking, you know, okay, so what is enough? What is enough to maintain my salvation? You know, I got saved at a young age. I got baptized the right way. I've kept all the law. Jesus asked the guy. You know, the guy comes to him, the rich young ruler, what must I do, you know, to inherit eternal life? Oh, we'll do that. Well, I've done all that. Oh, yeah, I mean, it's good to go. So people come in and asking these questions. Well, I've done that, and I've done that, and I've done that. Now what? How could you be sure? And I think, you know, when maybe looking at these verses in Romans, because we jump to this point, you know, boy, and people will quote, you know, these verses all the time. All sin and come short. That's, you know, other than, you know, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. You know, I think that's the second most quoted verse in the Bible. The first one is, we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. But you know what Paul is saying here, and he goes on because there's a few more quotes to make his point. Again, in verse 13, their throats are open graves, their tongues practice deceit. That's from Psalms 5. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Again, Psalm 140. Verse 14, their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Psalm 10. Now what Paul has done is went through this encyclopedia of verses that's in his mind, searched through his memory of the scriptures, and created this neat little progression of a metaphor here for us, right? He's pulled. I mean, who would do that? Who would take one line from Psalm 140 and two lines from 114 and one from 5 and one from Isaiah to create all of this, right? It's like, Paul, man, though we have to stay in context here. But he's using this because he wants to get his meaning across, right? Everything Paul does quoting scripture is incredibly intentional. Now look at what he does here. Their throat, open sepulcher, open graves, tongues that practice deceit, lips covered in poison, mouths full of bitterness. Now, you know, Paul, he's a great weaver, you know, a weaver. Very skillful at weaving of different psalms together into a brand new poetic depiction of how sin starts somewhere deep inside and works its way out into the world. Man, I would love to talk long about these things. One of the things, I go back, and I don't say this funny, but I understand. But one of the things I was reading, and somebody posted a prayer on there, and it was about all these attacks of Satan. I don't know if you've seen the last. It was just Satan this, Satan this, Satan this. And, you know, man, it's like, And I understand that, guys. I do understand it. And it comes to us this way. And you know, it's always there to help us. But when you begin and go on and you begin to understand these things, anyway, Paul is making this point that these sins start somewhere deep inside and works its way out to the world. Yeah, and he's making a bigger point about how all of us mess up and how no one is immune to brokenness. And he's going to come back to that. But he's also crafted this little moment in the middle of this poem here talking where our worst moments come from. I know these things are hard to believe. You know, you remember the old Flip Wilson line that you say all the time, the devil made me do it. I believe, wasn't that Flip Wilson? You say that all the time. Devil made me do it. Devil made me do it. And I'm sure, you know, we all have some moments we'd like to take a mulligan on. You know what a mulligan is? That's a golf term. That's when you hit one terrible shot, and I'm taking a mulligan. I'm going to do over. Maybe we got more than one. But in those moments that we regret, they didn't come from nowhere. Sometimes it feels like I just say something stupid or insensitive or uncaring out of nowhere, but they don't come out of nowhere. But if you look back, really, and you're honest, and you see how maybe in that situation, maybe before that situation, during the day, maybe I was frustrated and focused too much energy on that, you know, because there is an energy there. I mean, really, if you kind of understand how these things work. And I always say one of the great things, if you want to go and learn, watch a ball game, watch a college basketball game, and watch how things are. And then all of a sudden, you can see. Tim knows, Dad knows. There's a momentum shift, and you can see it. And I mean, there's a real energy there, and I mean, it's really real. And man, if you're not paying attention, you can get caught up into that energy. Next thing you know, you're standing up and cheering. You don't even know who's playing. Why am I even here? And you get caught. So, I heard this guy, and I don't know if you ever watched ducks. I'm talking quack, quack, ducks. Sometimes they'll fight. Have you ever seen a duck fight? And then, you know, one of them will kick the other one's butt, and they'll run him off. And then you ever seen the ducks just stand up in the water, flap their wings like crazy? That's that release of that energy, and then boom, they're just right back to business. Josh was in at Dad's the other day, and what happened? The dog has got all this energy, and the man, he's bouncing all the walls. I've got to take him out. You just throw the ball because he's got to get this energy out. Well, kids, well, they got all this energy, right? And they're just bouncing off the walls, all this energy. So there is an energy here, and we can focus too much on that, and then we come into another situation, and now all of that energy, negative or positive, comes out. Pow. So it didn't start from nowhere. We don't pay no, oh, well, the devil maybe. No, you've been frustrated for 2 weeks. You ain't known how to deal with it, and then this happened, and boom, you bit their head off. So you can see how you kind of bring a sense of entitlement or selfishness or arrogance into an encounter with somebody else that's got nothing to do with it. And Paul's kind of throwing that at us here. And if we could learn to do that, I mean, you know, pay attention here. And, you know, what Paul is saying here, every embarrassing thing that I allow out of my mouth, it started in my throat, formed with my tongue, passed through my lips. Every moment along the way, I could have stopped it. James would talk about this, right? How the tongue is a rudder that does the whole ship here. Out of your tongue proceeds life and death. I mean, right? So Paul is using this kind of language here. And this kind of a language here, which sounds mystical right here, it is, but it isn't. I see, and man, I'm you know, re-looking at things again, but you are what you feed. Well, and how could I say that? Paul says you reap what you sow. You sow to the flesh, and boy, that's a word we're really going to have to look at really, 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 really deep. What do you reap? Corruption. I mean, this is Pauline language here. Destruction. Well, now, God doesn't want you to be destroyed, but where does these things come from? So I'm focused on this situation. I will say this. Maybe we can talk about this a little more later, but do you know? Now, this is going to sound very, very, very strange, but do you know there is a right distance in relationship? There's a right distance. Too close, and it's funny how you said that, Kathy. Too close, and identities get lost. One becomes a tyrant over the other. Too far away, that just doesn't work. So there is a right, I mean, there is, you remember one of these verses, there is no fear. The fear of the Lord is not in him. You see, the fear of the Lord helps keep the right relations, the right distance in relationship. And there has to be distance. And I know we thought, well, these two are joined together and they become one. Well, they do in that sense, but there also has to be the proper distance. And you know, boy, we get, that gets all out of whack. Well, I can tell you this, that is part of the thing that's going on with the whole Egypt and Israel and Egypt and all of that right there. Things are out of whack, out of kilter, one way or the other. That's a whole nother story. But Paul is reminding us that our worst moments don't just happen out of the blue. They happen because we put our energy behind them a long time ago. Now, the good news here is that the natural consequence of something else is also true. Now, what you put your energy into that's positive leads to positive outcomes. But we have to be aware, awake to what we are doing. Because you remember this kind of, you know, God forbid, or Paul is saying, oh, hell no, because it's like, well, why should we keep the law? Why don't we just do? Well, there's some energies right here. I mean, there really is these things going on. And, you know, these things are all out of whack. We can kind of see it going on. I'll throw this out there. Do you remember when, you remember the situation that happened when Moses was born? You remember what was going on? They wanted to kill all which children? The boys. Why not the girls? I mean, you know, we kind of think naturally here. But, well, you know, what does this represent? But they wanted to feminize the population. Does this sound familiar? I mean, it's more than just, you know, rising. I know they said all of this, but, you know, there's a whole lot there in this deep, deep mystery that God has given us. They wanted to feminize the culture. Well, what do we see going on today? I'll just say this real quick. You know, growing up and up till the last, I guess, a little bit, unless I'm out of the loop, you know who the greatest, strongest superhero was? And I'm talking comic book eras and all that. Superman. Nobody can beat Superman. Superman. Well, now they got a superhero that is the strongest in the universe. The greatest of all, even stronger than Superman. Do you know who it is? It's Captain Marvel. But do you know Captain Marvel is a woman? I mean, if we, you know, would pay attention even maybe to culture, we kind of see the stuff's going on. But anyway, back, sometimes people lose control of their emotions, and one of the reasons that terrible things come out of our mouth is because we're not aware of them when they're in our throats, if you will. And noting what Paul does here in the middle of his quote in Romans, it helps us to realize that before we find ourselves in the red zone, you know what I mean, in the red zone, saying things that we'll regret, there are all of these little steps that provide an opportunity for us to notice what is happening inside and redirect that into healthier ways. Now, I'm always thinking of Andy Taylor sitting on the desk, and he says, look at that foot. How in the world did I get that whole thing in my mouth? See, simply knowing that you're angry helps you to not act out of anger. You know, be angry, but sin not. And the problem is a lot of us just don't know when we're angry because we think all of this other, but you know, there's this little frustration that's working, going on down inside of us. This kind of brought me back to that very question. Well, we left this church and we're looking. I'm like, you know, have you ever seen a kid that just would cry? You know, they're like 2 years old. What are you crying for? I don't know. Those three words that you hate, I don't know. What's going on? I don't know. Are you hungry? I don't know. Why are you crying? I don't know. Like I said, doing it on the positive side, you know, it's important because, you know, Paul would talk about in Philippians, you know, Colossians, set your mind on things above. In Philippians, think on these things. So if you want to be a more kind person, then start focusing on more kind thoughts. What are you focused on? Paul would tell us, set your affections on things above. Because everything else will want to pull your energy away. If you wish you were a more generous person, then maybe we need to stop looking for the internet for all the things we're going to buy when we get rich. Sometimes maybe if we want to be the kind of person other people turn to when they're moment of need, then maybe we may pay attention to them, put our phones down when they're not in the moment of need. Be present. But there's still two more quotes here. Let me get back on this. That Paul packs on before he moves on. There, verse 15 through 17, their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. The way of peace they do not know. This is from Isaiah 59. And verse 18, there is no fear of God before their eyes. Psalm 36. That's six different passages woven together that Paul gathers to make his point. And the basic theme here is, wait for it, people mess up. They're violent, they're hurtful, they're selfish, they're arrogant, even in the face of a loving God. And ultimately, Paul's point here is that it doesn't matter whether you are a Jew or not. All of this describes all of us in some way, great or small. All of it. And what's interesting about this is that each of these psalmic references would have been used in synagogues of the day in a very different way. Now, quoting a scholar here, James Dunn, a leading Pauline scholar, he says, all of these passages would have normally been read within the synagogues as bolstering the assumption that the Jewish righteous could plead with God against the Gentile wicked. See, I know these are hard to understand because we're Gentiles, we don't have that culture. But really, they thought we're the righteous. God gave us the law. In other words, all of Paul's former colleagues, remember, because Paul had to leave, they would have been just as familiar with all of these passages as Paul is. It's just they would have said, yeah, that applies to them and not us. So Paul's argument boils down to this. When the scripture says that no one is righteous, no one understands, no one seeks God, no one does good, no one fears the Lord, what they really mean is no one. No one. Now remember, this is the argument that he's making in the church here. Now remember, for Paul, that's not a problem, because for Paul, the good news is that when we were, even when we were not, God is always faithful. Now remember, I mean, just thinking, you know, because think about the anxiety here coming from the Jews. Oh my God, you're telling me I'm not righteous? How will God ever be faithful to me then? But see, for Paul, he's met the risen Savior on the road to Damascus, and he realizes, it doesn't matter. Man, I was killing people. I was a terrorist. And look, called to be an apostle, separated. But see, if you're playing in a sandbox that says good news is about coloring inside of the lines, or good news is about being good enough to earn God's favor, or good news is being born into a special chosen people with special access to God, then you're probably going to have a big problem with what Paul's saying here. But what Paul has realized through his encounter with Jesus is that good news was never about playing by the rules anyway. It's always and only ever about trust that God would do good for you. That's faith. No matter what's going on, God's going to do good. So Paul is not trying to beat us up with the fact that you're not perfect, which is how the church poses it, don't it? Paul is not trying to beat you up with that fact. He knows really that you already know that. We're deeply aware of our own flaws, unless we're just absolutely so arrogant. But really, the arrogance is just another form of trying to cover up our flaws. He's not beating us up. He's saying, I know and you know, but it's okay. Isn't it amazing? See, we never follow up. We just quote, well, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Nobody ever follows it up and just says, you know what? It's okay. God is good. God is faithful. Yeah, we did it. We messed it up. And Paul is just saying, you know what, guys? You don't need to pretend anymore. God's got this. Look at what he says here in verse 19. Now we know what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may be become guilty before God. This is where he comes back with his own commentary. We used to think that all of that applied to them and not us. And now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those that are under the law also, so that every mouth may be silenced, the whole world held accountable before God. And verse 20, therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by or through the law is the knowledge of sin. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight simply by works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. Now, that might sound like a downer to end on, but that's only if you are intent on trying to be something that you can't. Because taken in the larger context of everything that Paul has been saying, his point here is, guys, the rules never worked anyway. They just made you feel bad about yourself, but it's okay. Because no one will ever be declared righteous simply by staying in the lines. Instead, the good news, the news of Jesus, is that the righteousness of God is being revealed, a righteousness that is his faithfulness from first to last. God will make all things right, even when we mess it up. Now, Romans 3 here only makes sense in light of Romans 1. That's how it works. Remember, you've got to keep all those together. So Paul's goal here, as we close here, Paul's goal isn't to grind us down. It's to invite us to let go of expectations that were never really realistic to start with, so that we could discover faith in the God who is faithful to us. And may we sense in our spirit the God, our Father, as a parent, nurturing us, calls us not to earn divine favor, but to rest in the knowledge of divine embrace, that you're held. Rest in that. Because life, boy, this is a statement here. Life was not designed as a test to test you that you were destined to fail. That's the most that rules can offer you anyway. And that's what actually Paul has argued against. He's saying that life was created as an opportunity for you to discover the you that comes from trusting God. That God will always be there to catch you. That's what he's inviting us into. An opportunity for you to discover the you that comes from trusting God. How does that, when you know me, you'll know you? Yeah. That's what he's saying. And the rest of it, what? It's all fake. Let God be true and every man a liar. It's this. This is what God has created us for. Why would we go this other route? Anyway, we will pick up right there next week. Romans, finish out chapter 3, moving into chapter 4. So we'll quit with that. Lord bless.